Thanks so much. Hello, and welcome to the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists, Revisiting the Founding Debates, the Federalist Society's 2022 National Student Symposium. My name is Jessie Mann, and I am the chair for this year's symposium. I'd like to begin by thanking you all for attending, especially those who traveled from across the country and even across the globe to be here. The theme of this year's symposium, the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists, begs a simple question. Who won our founding debates? While the question may be simple, you'll find that the answers to it decidedly are not, nor are its implications for America as a whole. In a sense, America never stopped debating the founding. And we're here this weekend to continue that favorite national pastime. No, not baseball. The symposium was a labor of love, and it came together thanks to the symposium committee, who spent endless hours preparing for this weekend. The event is going to be amazing because of you all. Thanks to Dean Goluboff and the Law School Foundation for being so supportive and making all of this possible. Thanks Peter and Jean and the Federalist Society for giving us the honor of hosting this year's symposium and supporting us every step of the way. Thank you to our AV and facilities teams, and a special thanks to our chapter members for all their work volunteering this weekend. When you see one of our amazing volunteers, be sure to say hi. They're eager to meet you. Throughout this weekend, you should expect to hear from some of the most esteemed legal minds in the country, from across the academic and judicial spectrums, tackling a wide range of subjects like originalism, executive power, and the rise of American populism. Later tonight, you'll even have the opportunity to hear from Governor Glenn Youngkin, who has been so kind to speak to us. I hope you're all as excited as I am about all the events we have planned for this weekend and the speakers and moderators who have so graciously agreed to join us. So, to kick off this year's symposium, I am honored to call Dean of UVA Law, Risa Golubov, to the stage to deliver the opening remarks. She's been wonderfully supportive of our chapter and the symposium. Please join me in welcoming Dean Golubov. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome. We are so pleased to be hosting this National Student Symposium and so excited to be able to do it in person. Jean was saying before, this is the first time in 3 years that one of these will happen in person, so we're glad that it's here. Thank you, Jessie, for that wonderful welcome to everyone, and thank you to the members of UVA Law's Federalist Society chapter, especially President Chloe Knox, as well as Jessie Mann, for inviting me to welcome you tonight. It takes many hands, as Jessie just said, to bring a 2-day conference of this breadth and depth together. Thank you to the symposium committee and all of the volunteers, to the speakers and panelists who have dedicated their time, to the National Federalist Society and Jean Mayer, which has provided invaluable support to our students as they've organized the symposium, and to the many people at UVA Law, both faculty and staff, who have lent their time and talents to this event. I'm delighted to be with you tonight to kick off this weekend's events, which, as Jessie said, is about the founding debates between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. As a constitutional law professor and legal historian, these are exciting events to me, and we have a host of terrifically accomplished scholars, practitioners, and judges from across the country and from just upstairs who are all here to probe the meaning of the nation's founding debates and to explore how both the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists influence that founding moment, as well as our country as it is today. I have no doubt that this weekend will be marked by vibrant discussion and debate, and I hope and trust that you will both enjoy the weekend and your time at UVA Law School and leave here edified and intellectually stimulated. I am now delighted to introduce our keynote speaker this evening. Glenn Allen Youngkin is the 74th governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Governor Youngkin was raised in Richmond and Virginia Beach. He attended Rice University on a basketball scholarship. I'm going to raise this podium when I go. He graduated in 1990 with degrees in managerial studies and mechanical engineering, and he later received an MBA from Harvard Business School. Governor Youngkin briefly worked at the corporate consulting firm McKinsey & Company before joining the Carlyle Group, the Washington, D.C.-based private equity giant that now has more than $300 billion of assets under management. Governor Youngkin rose through the ranks in his 25 years at the Carlyle Group, and he played many key roles there, including leading the firm's expansion into Europe and helping orchestrate its initial public offering in 2012. He capped his remarkable career there by becoming, in 2018, co-chief executive. When Governor Youngkin left the firm in 2020, he did so because he felt called to public service. That is what he noted in his farewell letter to his colleagues. And indeed, he has answered that call. He began in 2020 by responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. He and his wife, Suzanne, founded Virginia Ready, a nonprofit organization helping Virginians find career pathways that are family-sustaining and fulfilling. And then, not yet Governor Youngkin, formally entered the gubernatorial race in January of 2021. Less than a year after declaring that candidacy, he was sworn in as governor in Virginia on January 15th of this year. He now holds the office that was held in the past by the likes of Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and James Monroe, notable predecessors to mention at the start of a conference on the Federalists and Anti-Federalists. They, all three of those, are also notably all lawyers. Now, though Governor Youngkin is not himself a lawyer, I hope that his decision to serve the public resonates with all of you law students in the audience. I often tell our students here at UVA that every lawyer, by virtue of their legal education and law license, holds a public trust to serve the public and promote the public good. And I also tell them that their careers are long and varied, and there are so many ways to discharge that trust over the course of their careers, including through careers that span both the private sector and public service. Governor Youngkin provides an excellent model for this path. It is possible to have immense success in the private sector, as he did, and then to enter government when called to do so, to apply the skills you learn in one field to another setting, to be a basketball player and an engineer and a CEO and a governor. Governor, we are so pleased to welcome you to UVA and to host you as the keynote speaker for the Federalist Society's 2022 National Student Symposium. I know that this audience is eager to hear from you, so without further ado, please welcome Governor Youngkin.
How much fun. Thank you. Thank you all very, very much. I am so excited about being with all of you. And I just want to thank your dean for such an extraordinarily welcoming introduction. My mother would be very proud. So thank you. This is an extraordinary event, and to see it happening at the University of Virginia Law School is extra exciting. And so I, too, want to make sure we all say thank you to the extraordinary committee that worked so hard to get ready for this event. I know you've had the strong support of the dean and the law school leadership as well. And so I want to congratulate you all. It is such an honor to be in the presence of so many esteemed conservative federal judges as well, who epitomize what it means to uphold the Constitution instead of rewriting it. Thank you for your service. For those of you who have come to Virginia for this weekend, you've come from other schools, you've come from other states, I want to say welcome. Virginia is known for many, many things, two of which are our history and our hospitality. And I hope that you are already receiving healthy helpings of both. We hope you'll come back and visit us many times. And as many people have heard me say, Virginia is open for business. Please come do it here. Now, you don't have to be governor to know that when you come to the hallowed grounds of the University of Virginia, there are two people that you must salute. One is our founder, Mr. Jefferson. You know, Mr. Jefferson hit the trifecta. He, of course, was the first rector of the University of Virginia. He was the second governor of the great Commonwealth of Virginia, and of course, he was the third president of the United States. The other is Coach Tony Bennett. He was the architect of UVA's national title, and for those of you that have seen great basketball, you will, of course, appreciate that great run. Extraordinary. I've seen many, many great basketball games in my life, and okay, I had the privilege to maybe play in one or two. But to watch what that team did, it's a testament. It's a testament to the power of perseverance. It's a testament to teamwork, to selflessness, to character. We need more leaders like Tony Bennett, who show us not only how to win, but how to live life. So thank you, Thomas Jefferson, and thank you, Coach Bennett. And since we're here talking about the Constitution, maybe I should say something about James Madison. You know, Mr. Madison's home is right up the road in Montpelier, just a few miles from here, and it was in his library that the father of the Constitution, he closeted himself for months studying the history of republics all the way from classical times to the Enlightenment, distilling the ideals and principles that would supply the foundation for our Constitution. You know, that Constitution, this charter of self-government for a free and purposeful people, has withstood the test of time. Nearly 2.5 centuries later, it is still the envy of the world, a model and source of inspiration, and at the same time, a very real and relevant presence in our everyday lives here at home. So while we revel in the greatness of the Constitution, we often spend less time focusing on the good work it enables and the paths it charts for us. So this evening, I'm going to talk about 3 constitutional principles. And for all of you constitutional scholars, I'm only talking about 3. I know someone wants to talk about separation of powers. I hear about it every day from my legislative colleagues. And yes, we don't want to forget popular sovereignty. But tonight, I want to talk about federalism, individual rights, and the rule of law. And I'm going to raise a challenge for all of you to consider how you can play a role bringing our Constitution to life in all of our lives, not only in studying and debating the principles, which are very important because otherwise you wouldn't have a symposium, but also putting these principles to work for the improvement of your community, your state, and your country. So let's talk about federalism. These days, we often hear about this rhetoric about the impending demise of democracy. And of course, some of it's overblown. But we have to admit, when you watch the extremism and the dysfunction in Washington these days, a reaction of discouragement, even alarm, sometimes seems justified. Madison gave us checks and balances. But today in our nation's capital, it often seems like leaders have checked out and the balances in the idea bank have dropped to 0. Most of the time up there is spent in gotcha games. It takes forever to get anything done, and that oftentimes means it never gets done. But that's not what happens at the state level. And this would not have surprised Madison and the framers. They created a national government limited, enumerated powers that were reserved to the states and to the people. And today, as they foresaw it, it's the people in the states, and I might add, states led by Republican governors, that are charting the future and getting things done. Federalism, after all, is not only a structure that prevents excess and overreach by those who would take away our freedom. Federalism also is a structure that empowers people to exercise their freedom, to act together to improve their communities, to make their states a better place to live, work, and raise a family, to live a good life, and to help make life better for others. De Tocqueville made a lot of salient observations as he toured early America, but none were more important than his insight that the health of this and every democracy depends on preserving decision-making at the level closest to the people. Yeah. And he said that when government is centralized and distant, people don't think the well-being of their communities is their responsibility. They think it belongs, and I want to quote him here, to a powerful stranger called the government. They are so divorced from their own interests that even when their own security and that of their children is finally compromised, they do not seek to avert danger themselves, but they cross their arms and they wait for the nation as a whole to come to their aid. Fortunately, for all of us, the framers had a different vision, a vision of federalism and citizen engagement that has flourished. The heart of our democracy today is in the states, and that heart is healthy. It is healthy. I'll be governor here for 4 years. Now, some of you might be saying, don't undersell yourself. You could win re-election. The reality is that's the limit in Virginia. I am limited to one term of 4 years. And by the way, I have most of it yet to come. But during these next 4 years, if experience is a guide, our legislature will consider roughly 14,000 bills. And of those 14,000 bills, roughly 3,500 to 4,000 of them will reach my desk for me to sign, veto, or send back with amendments. Yes, it's good to be the governor of Virginia. Contrast that with Congress, which last year, in an entire year of work, 172 days, versus Virginia's either 45 days or 60 days, apparently passed and sent to the president a whopping 89 pieces of legislation. In addition, each of the bills that comes to me as governor will address a single subject, as our state constitution requires. They aren't like those massive bills, those omnibus bills in Congress that run hundreds of pages and cover thousands of topics with no ability to make individual policy judgments or to approve or reject individual spending items. And at the state level, the policy details are not left to legislative staffers, but delegates and senators do debate them mightily with passion in committees and on our House and Senate floor. Now, some of you may be thinking, okay, government probably does function better at the state level, but those decisions are small potatoes, and they don't have national impact. Well, buckle your seatbelt, because if you're thinking that, you're mistaken. Justice Brandeis famously referred to the states as laboratories for the creative development of public policy. He was right, and Virginia's proof of it. In years past, landmark legislation adopted here in Virginia on issues varying from truth in sentencing, welfare reform, education standards, these all became national models, and they became national public policy. Recently, we've seen another major example of this. While other states, both red and blue, following our lead on parental decision making, they specifically were debating whether children should wear masks in schools. Now, trusting parents was a major theme of this last election cycle. I have to say it was one of the major contributions to our winning. And on the first day as governor, I reversed my predecessor's executive order and gave parents the decision on masks. If they wanted their child to wear a mask, then wear one. And if you think that's in the best interest of your child not to wear one, then don't. Now, this was controversial at first. And I have to say, I was called everything but a gentleman. But then an interesting thing happened. As we sat down and discussed this with legislators of both parties, we found that a number of Democrats agreed. They agreed with the logic and the fairness of the position. They decided to follow the parents instead of the party line. And so on February 16th, just 1 month after I'd been inaugurated as the 74th governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, I signed into law bipartisan legislation resolving the mask war in favor of parents. Let's let parents decide. Think of that. A brand new governor, a divided legislature, a Democratic majority Senate, Republican majority House, taking on one of the hottest issues in the nation, resolving it, passing legislation, allowing me to sign it, all in the first month of an administration of someone who has never been involved in politics before. That is the sign of a healthy democracy. Our legislature is still in session today. In fact, I just left them. And we are hard at work on a range of other issues. This is where I'm reminded of separation of powers. And they will make a big difference in Virginians' lives, these issues that we are debating, these issues that we are working on. For example, Virginia has been and continues to run a massive surplus because our state government has been massively overtaxing Virginians. I believe it is the people's money. And so I proposed a package of major tax cuts. It's no longer a question, however, of whether Virginians will get a tax cut. It's a matter of how big will it be. And this is where they're working. Our Democratic-led Senate is proposing $2.5 billion of tax cuts. A Republican-led House is proposing $5.5 billion of tax cuts. I know where I want them to land. There has to be a balanced budget in Virginia. I know they will land. There will be major tax relief for Virginians because we know that we must work together to get it done. And the strength of our argument is compelling. So I hope you're getting the idea that it is possible, even in this time of partisan polarization, to get important things done at the state level. But I have a much more contemporary purpose in mind in telling you these stories, because I want to enlist all of you. Young people are more mission-oriented today than ever. You all want to make meaningful and lasting contributions. And I know that this is true, because as a parent, I have four of you as children, and I am surrounded by you every day at work. Take Hallie Pence. She's our senior policy analyst. She was on Capitol Hill and decided to leave federal government and come to state government because she wanted to have an impact. She's in her 20s. She works with our medical advisory team, leading professionals from Johns Hopkins, from all the universities, from health systems. She talks to the CDC even. She's making a difference. Or take Jen Deechee. Again, she's 7 or 8 years out of college. She's our Deputy Secretary of Transportation. And she is leading Virginians' effort to coordinate with all of the federal funds coming out of the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act to invest in Virginia's infrastructure $11 billion. It's happening at the state level. I could give you many, many more examples, but here's the point. If you want to serve and make a difference immediately, pick a state capital and join the front lines of self-government at the state level. Get engaged in the hard work of democracy, where democracy is working hard rather than hardly working, because we could use your help. So in the few minutes that are remaining, let me turn briefly to a couple of other constitutional principles and how they too provide opportunities to serve the greater good. The idea of individual rights is so fundamental to our Constitution that it's easy to forget that it took amending to get the Bill of Rights in there. James Madison was brilliant, but he wasn't perfect, just like the rest of us. And he benefited from both the demands of his constituents and the arguments of his adversaries. I always tell the story that Patrick Henry demanded that we have a Bill of Rights. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a Constitution. Virginia took that stand. You know, it's been said that the one truly original idea of the American founding fathers was the freedom of religion. No country before ours had the vision or courage to declare, in effect, faith is a matter of individual conscience, God-given right, and it occupies a space that no government, democratic or otherwise, may invade. Virginia led the way here. And if religious views could not be stifled, then neither could any other kind of individual expression. And so our First Amendment comes to stand for the first principle. Free expression is a hallmark of a free society. But is it a hallmark today? That's the question we ask ourselves. Is it a hallmark in the corridors of power across the country? Is it a hallmark in our companies, in our communities? How about our campuses? Our great colleges and universities draw diverse people from all around the country and all around the globe. But when they arrive, do students find these communities to be open, welcoming of diverse ideas? Are they encouraged, equipped, and empowered to think for themselves and express the views without fear? Or are they more often subjected to a stifling conformity dreary ideological sameness, encountering fellow students and even some faculty who would rather drown out dissenting views than debate them. I cherish the debate. I have found over and over again that it is the merit of the arguments that allow us to win, not the volume of the voice. The greatest threat to our democracy today comes not from tyrants abroad, but let me tell you, Vladimir Putin is a tyrant. The greatest threat to our democracy. The greatest threat to our democracy comes from a growing tendency to loathe rather than listen. Friends, it comes from a desire to bully and not persuade. Such a culture of contempt, this cancel culture, is toxic to our democracy. And unless the schools that exist to teach our young people take responsibility for being a solution, our democracy will indeed be in danger. As members of the Federalist Society and influential voices on campuses all over this nation, I encourage you, I ask you, stand up, speak out boldly. Speak out boldly for the principles of free expression and individual opportunity. So finally, let me conclude with a brief reflection on the rule of law. The tragic events of this past week have painfully reminded us that in the long span of history, democracy and the rule of law occupy a relatively small and fragile place. We are blessed to live in the longest surviving republic in history. What has sustained us is our fidelity to the Constitution and our abiding conviction that no person is above the law. That's not to say that the principles have never been violated. On day one as governor, I had to fire all five members of our parole board. I had to fire them for flagrantly breaking the law. I told our legislators in my first joint address that if we won't tolerate lawlessness in our communities, we can't tolerate it in state agencies. You know, another place we can't tolerate it is in our schools. That's why a bill requiring that all crimes occurring in school be reported to the police will soon be on its way to my desk. We simply can't say to young people that the law counts when you're out in the community. But if you commit the same offense in school, we're going to shield you from accountability. That sends the exact wrong message. This principle of equal justice under the law and fidelity to the rule of law are especially important in these troubling times that we live in. With so many of our institutions and ideals under assault, with so many politicians willing to justify any means to achieve a partisan goal or bend any fact to fit a partisan narrative, we desperately need young people, dare I say, young lawyers, with the clarity and integrity to stand up for the rule of law. And we need you to stand up for it not only in the elected branches of our government, but in our courts. An independent judiciary is an indispensable part of our constitutional system. Judges make our republic possible by faithfully interpreting the law. But the reverse is also true. Judges can make self-government impossible. They thwart the will of the people when they bend the law to enact their own preferences. Here is where the Federalist Society has made perhaps the greatest of all contributions. cultivating, identifying, and supporting men and women who have become stellar judges. Thank you. I want to thank all of you for this work, which I know you will continue. Our republic is stronger, our freedom is safer, our constitutional system is sounder than any time in recent memory. Please keep up this good work because it makes all the difference. Now, all of this work, in fact, matters. The constitutional principles that we've talked about tonight are brought together this weekend. And in every day of our lives, ordinary men and women depend on them. And as citizens of the freest society in the history of mankind, we have an unparalleled opportunity, an obligation to put these principles to work and pass them along. I hope that maybe I've at least cracked open a door that some of you would consider service at the state level. Wherever and however you choose to serve, please remember these words of Mr. Jefferson. The God who gave us life gave us liberty at the same time. The Lord planted a love of freedom in every human heart, and he set us free not to live for ourselves, but to love and serve others. The grace we have received, we must extend to others. The opportunities we have enjoyed, we must open up for others. The more perfect union founded by imperfect men that we have all inherited, we must render more perfect still for others. I know many of you will heed this call, and I am so grateful for your commitment to serve. May God bless each and every one of you. May God bless the Commonwealth of Virginia, and may God bless the United States of America. Thank you all very much. Thank you.